getting older. Cannot sleep, got random pain.
In some ways you're wiser, bolder, but you're sweating.
It's like rain.
Search for answers, getting colder. They can't fix it, can't explain.
Your anxiety will smolder.
You've become a sex withholder.
There's bursitis in your shoulder.
'Cause you're circling the drain. Circling the drain. Circling
the drain.
Circling, circling the drain.
Down the drain.
Hello, and welcome to the Circling the Drain podcast. I'm Ellie Dvorkin-Dunn. I'm 45, and I know I'm in perimenopause because I suddenly have more dark nipple hairs. We'll dive into that shortly, Julia.
And I'm Julia Granacki. I'm 46, and I know I'm in perimenopause because I have dark facial hairs.
Ooh, I love when our issues align.
Yeah, so perfectly. So tell me more about your nips.
Listen, I'm not a very hairy person.
It's true, listeners. It's true. I can attest to that.
Like, I'm not like covered in lots of dark hairs. And, you know, I don't know, at some point in the past several years, I've noticed here or there, like one sort of soft, dark one around the nipple. And I would like tweeze it and then I wouldn't see anything for ages. And, you know, I texted you this the other day. We've been taking collagen peptide powder, which is supposed to help your hair and nail growth and everything. And I don't know if it's related to that or not, but all I'm saying is I feel like every day I look down at my nipples and there are a few long, dark hairs around them and I'll tweeze them. And then the next day, there are some with the same exact length and texture. So it's not like I have three on my right nipple and I tweeze them and then there's stubble that slowly grows back. Like overnight, long, soft ones are replacing the ones that I've tweezed. It's a conundrum. It's weird science. It's, I don't know. I mean, they're not like thick and black and coarse and curly. They're just there. And yeah. What it makes me worry about, Julia, yeah, is the amount of maintenance and keeping track of myself to just like present like a normal non-troll human in the world. Like, you know, I'm like on top of my shit. So the minute I get to an age where I'm a little bit addled, like how hairy and crusty and like gnarly am I going to fucking be? Like, am I going to have to give Josh or my home nurse that is imaginary a roadmap to like, every day you must tweeze three hairs from the right nipple and two from the left, but don't forget the one on my chin. And also, like, it's a lot of stuff. And you have them on your face is what you're saying.
I do. Ellie, you and I have, it's, you know, there's a reason we have this podcast together because we think the same way, but I too am just like, you know, I remember getting a pedicure like many, this is like, you know, pre-pandemic, way pre-pandemic. It's just, you know, something that happened. So I'm getting my pedicure. Next to me is this older woman. She was probably like in her, I would say in her 80s. I'm not even kidding. So like up there. And she was getting a pedicure and she was like, you know, I was a dancer most of my life and my feet are kind of gnarly, you know, basically is what she was saying to the woman doing her feet. And it was kind of like being apologetic. And then I was like, oh my God, like, is that going to be me with my gnarly feet? And then, you know, I was like, and then what about like my roots? Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll just be gray. So that's fine. But then I'm like, all the hairs. Yes, all the hairs.
All the hairs
is what I was thinking about. Like, who will pluck the hairs? At least, you know, you have a child. So, like, potentially, like, not that Charlie's going to pluck your hairs. But,
please. I do not want to do that
there,
to him.
Listen, for the women out there who have daughters, I feel like I would pluck my mother's hairs. If she was like, can you get this chin hair? I'd be like, sure, Mom, let me get that for you. But, you know, my husband and I are going to be paying people to take care of us. And I feel like that's a whole new level of asking someone to, like, remove a hair. Like, you have to be really close to them or like paying them a lot of money is the way that I feel about it. But I don't know, maybe we won't care. My situation is that I feel like I don't have hair on my face and then I do. So it's like, there are these two, you know, that I kind of pluck on a regular basis and I have to put my little reading glasses on, you know, in the bathroom and I pluck like one on my chin, one on the side of my face. But listeners, I sent Ellie a picture of this hair like 2 weeks ago that grew out of this, like the side of my chin. And the worst part was that I didn't notice it until it was like an inch and a half long. And nobody fucking told me. And I'm like, anybody tell, like my husband didn't tell me. Now, maybe people didn't notice, but y'all, it was gray and it was thick. And it was like
long,
and I'm not exaggerating. It was at least an inch long, and I'm not exaggerating.
I really do think that these hairs don't grow slowly over time. I think they like magically sprout overnight. I really do too. Because you pay good attention, and you would have noticed it if it was there for weeks or slowly coming. Like I really think it just, you know, you watered yourself well, and you got enough sunlight that day.
Right. Like, I mean, listen,
your soil was fertile, and the hair just sprouted to 2 inches. I don't know.
It's not science, bitch, but I think you're right.
The final thing I want to say about all of this is like, I'm really glad we can admit these things and admit them freely, because obviously we're not alone. And, you know, people listening feel not alone. They're like, yes, me too. I have that too. But I have to tell you, I think I have told you, you know, we've interviewed people that live in my neighborhood. And so people in my neighborhood listen to the podcast, and I'll be walking down the street and a friend or an acquaintance will so lovingly say like, oh my gosh, I've been listening to your podcast and I love it. And I'm filled with good feelings and vibes for a moment. And then as I walk away from them, I'm mentally going back over what I've ever talked about. And I'm like, well, great. Now that woman knows that I shit my pants. I have nipple hairs. I fucked in the Empire State Building, like all the various. And, you know, I try not to feel like I want to die, but because it's more important, I think, to share and become a community, but also maybe not everyone that I see in person needs to know these things about me. It's okay. It's
agreed. Fine. But it's fine.
It's fine. It's fine. Everything's fine.
It's fine. It's fine. It's fine.
And with that, it's time for...
That is not a thing!
I'm so excited to do this, Ellie. Thank you for letting me do this segment.
You have permission to do everything. I'm not the boss of you.
Oh, thank you. Thanks. I needed to hear that. Thank you. All right. Dear listeners, I would like to discuss the topic of what many folks in the health and wellness industry refer to as hormone balance. In fact, we have used this terminology many times on the show, but after a lot of thought and careful research, there is a conclusion I would like to offer up. Hormone balance is not a thing. Your hormones fluctuate throughout the month in accordance with your cycle, and if you're in perimenopause, your progesterone and estrogen are slowly being depleted until your ovaries' final gasp when menopause occurs, which, if you remember, is a retrospective diagnosis in that you cannot say you're in menopause until you have not had your period for a year. If your progesterone and estrogen are depleting over time, there is no balance. There is only adding to what you have with hormone replacement therapy or using the birth control to halt ovulation and trick the body into thinking it is pregnant. Now, alternatively, you can just let your body sort it naturally with all the ups and downs until your ovaries cease production of these hormones, and that's okay too. But either way, there is no balancing act during this process. There is only keeping your progesterone and estrogen within range with the use of HRT or birth control pill or letting your ovaries run out of progesterone and estrogen. I mean, that all of that is up to you, but that is it. Those are the choices. So with that, I would like to introduce the phrase hormone support. So you can support the perimenopausal hormone process with HRT, the pill, or through health and lifestyle adjustments to make the transition to menopause a bit easier. But balance, my friend, is in fact not a thing.
Well, well done.
Thank you.
That was gripping. Yeah. I am like balancing on the edge of my seat, which I know does not count as hormonal balance. It's just physical butt balance.
That's amazing. You know, I sit in a kneeling chair. Oh. I don't know if anyone's familiar. And so I'm constantly feeling a little like I might fall off. I don't know. But now tell them who we have on the pod today, Ellie. Tell me.
Try not to fall off your chair. Today, we have Dr. Mandy Leonhart, a GP and menopause specialist based in the UK, who focuses on women's hormonal health, including early menopause, perimenopause, actual menopause, and premenstrual disorders. She's also the founder, organizer, and host of England's first menopause cafe. I can't wait to learn more about what that is because it sounds bloody delightful. Like I'm picturing tea and little cakes in the shape of uteruses. Or is it, uteri? Would it be like
uteri? I believe both are correct.
Oh, tomato, tomato. Uteruses.
Exactly.
Uteri. Got it.
Sure. Yeah.
I'd like to welcome Dr. Mandy Leonhardt to the CTD podcast today.
Dr. Mandy Leonhardt is a fully qualified and GMC registered GP. She is particularly interested in women's health, nutrition, and healthy aging. She offers a private clinic which specializes in the holistic assessment and individualized treatment of hormonal imbalances at every stage of a woman's life, premenstrual syndrome, PMS, perimenopause, and menopause. She aims to give women the best evidence-based, personally tailored advice about treatment options for hormonal imbalances and healthy aging. She works in a multidisciplinary team and liaises with other women's health professionals such as gynecologists, urogynecology nurse specialists, and physiotherapists. Together with another medical colleague, she is the founder, organizer, and host of England's first Menopause Cafe, which I'm so excited to get into later and hear more about. The Menopause Cafe concept is a social franchise which was started by Rachel Rowan from Perth in Scotland. And these pop-up events are free and provide an opportunity for women and men and everyone else who is interested to exchange experiences and to have conversations about any issues related to menopause in a safe and confidential space alongside a cup of tea, coffee, and cake. Menopause Cafe was featured on TV by the BBC Southwest Lunchtime and Evening News, as well as on BBC Solent Breakfast Radio. Dr. Leonhardt has also been interviewed by BBC Solent on several occasions about menopause related to news and issues. Dr. Mandy Leonhardt, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Julia, and thank you, Ellie. So, yes, thank you for the very long introduction. I never thought... I'm actually surprised about all my achievements. When you read them out loud, it sounds not too bad. You think, wow, is that me?
You're very impressive.
You are. Yeah, well, thank you.
So even though you're here in the capacity of doctor and expert, no one can escape the opening statement that we demand everyone make. So with that, please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Ellie. So my name is Mandy Leonhardt. I'm 46 and I am in perimenopause because I no longer have the patience to put up with other people's bullshit.
Yes, I hear that.
I hear that.
Yeah, that's enough, really, that
is,
right?
Is it? Yeah. I think it makes me sound very angry, but I'm not an angry person. I just don't have my bucket of patience is limited now, whereas previously it was more flexible, I guess. Now I reach my limit very quickly.
Yes, a friend of mine who is also in perimenopause described it as being able to pause before reacting to whatever might overfill your bucket. And when your hormones reach a certain state, I guess, you lose that pause, right? Mm-hmm. That's what it feels like.
I like the patience bucket. I'm going to use that later. My bucket of patience. My bucket of patience is like empty.
I think it's inversely correlated to your energy bucket.
Yes,
you know? Definitely. So if you have energy and if you had a good night's sleep and your children relaxed, then you have your patient bucket is more ready to kind of accept more stuff. Whereas if your energy bucket is drained, your patient bucket is very quickly full.
I like it.
Sense.
I think someone should make some kind of diagram to explain. Perhaps I will for the advertisement of this episode. That's a
two
meme.
Buckets.
It's already like, yes, I like
a
it.
A woman with her arms out just strung full of different kinds of buckets labeled with different things.
Yes.
Yeah, I like it.
Mandy, you're the second guest we've had on the show who's located in Europe, which makes us feel very worldly and internationally legitimate, just so you know. But it also makes us a bit sad that we and our American friends can't visit you easily. I have mixed feelings, which I think might be a symptom of perimenopause also.
Yes, I think, well, we live in a pandemic, which doesn't help.
No.
but it is difficult. And this is maybe taking your point a bit too far, but when we are perimenopausal, this is the first time maybe for many women where we realize our time, and this is our lifespan bucket, is limited. We have a limited lifespan, right? And I think perimenopause is this time when we have this awareness for the first time when it hits us. Oh my God, my life is not infinite, right? So my lifetime is not infinite. I will die at some stage. We all will. But I think it hits home a bit more. And I think that's where maybe your traveling desire comes from. I had a time when I really was not, when I had my children, I was not terribly interested in going very far and exotic and abroad. I just wanted somewhere safe and chilling and relaxed. But I now have more of a, you know, a list where I think, yes, that's something I would love to see, including America, for example. I worry about not being able to do that for whatever reasons. Maybe God knows how long this stupid pandemic will last, right? Yeah. Will we ever get anywhere again without worrying to get sick or make other people sick? Or
yeah.
So I think maybe is that a point that you maybe subconsciously worried about, Ellie?
For sure. Definitely. Right before the pandemic, my family and I had a trip to Copenhagen scheduled and had to cancel it. And I do feel that way all the time. I feel like, you know, I'm 45. I have a little boy who's ready to go. He's a great traveler. And when are we going to get to go again? And then the various buckets of anxiety, the anxiety bucket is full. Julie, are you making notes to add to your bucket graphic?
Yes, mental notes as we go. Lots of buckets. Yeah. But I mean, I align with this. And I also think that they call it a midlife crisis for a reason. And I have been going through it since I turned 40. It's just a one long crisis. So,
questioning everything.
Yeah.
Right?
And I think it's, for me, the biggest thing has had to do with my career. So I'm looking, you know, I'm in a career flux at the moment. But, you know, I've always loved to travel. So, and, you know, yeah, of course, I'm like, when are we ever going to get to go anywhere? It really sucks. But speaking of travel, let's talk about your journey to becoming a doctor that specializes in perimenopausal and menopausal women. How did that all start? Where is it going?
Yes. So I may have to kind of elaborate a little bit or discuss a little bit the differences between the German and the UK system.
Please do. I am so excited to hear all about this.
There will be overlaps with the American system that you will be very familiar with, that you that you will know, and there will be some things that you may not be familiar with. So in Germany, we have specialists like gynecologists who work outside the hospital. They have a surgery, a beautiful practice. So my gynecologist in Germany that I have seen since I'm 18. So you kind of turn 18 and then your mom says, you must see your gynecologist. And you think, why? Well, and then you find out why. So I've known her for a long, long time and I've seen her. I see her every year. But since moving to the UK, I have to see her privately. So she, because I have no longer German health insurance, which is fine. But this is a normal thing for German women or most European women in France and Spain, where I've got, you know, normally on the what they call the continent. The UK is not on the continent, right? Mm-hmm. We are outside the continent.
Correct.
So on the continent, women tend to see their gynecologists and they do not have to go through their GP. If they want the pill, if they want contraception, if they want HRT, if they have any issues with their periods or their hormones, they go to the gynecologist. And these are based outside hospitals. When I moved to the UK, I was really shocked because there was no such thing to see a gynecologist on demand. If you wanted, you had to see your GP. And then that was a little bit of a gamble. So you either saw a GP who had an interest or you saw a GP who was dismissive.
That's crazy. I had no idea.
Yes. So the GP is the gatekeeper towards the specialist system. If you want to see a specialist on the state health, which is paid for, which is free, you have to go through your GP and the GP will decide whether your symptoms are deemed bad enough to be referred to the secondary care into the hospital. And most gynecologists in the UK work within big hospitals. So they are surgeons as well. They are not normally interested in things like HRT. Now they are more so, but in the past, they're typically classically surgical people, surgeons. They're Mr. and Mrs., whereas, you know, they're not doctors. I don't know if you are familiar with that in the UK, a surgeon is not called a doctor. He's a Mr. or a Mrs.
Oh.
Even though he trained really hard to be a doctor.
A doctor.
Once they become surgeons, they start off as doctors after med school, then they qualify as a surgeon. They turn from a doctor to a Mr. or a Mrs.
That's so interesting.
I'm learning so much, Ellie.
Are your surgeons in the US called misters?
No, they're all doctors. But
in fact, I feel like that would be disrespectful.
Yeah, like the MD comes in the statement always, you must call it. Like, you know, for example, at my wedding.
Any kind of doctorate.
Yeah, any kind of doctorate, whether you're a psychologist or a master's of.
Even a professor.
Yeah. For example, you know, for my wedding, I had a doctor, a friend of mine who was coming. And when I made out the invitation, even though I called this person by their first name, I had to put doctor, you know, the appropriate thing was to write Dr. So-and-so like on the invitation, but to kind of echo what you were telling us about the system and having to go to the GP and get referred to a specialist. Yeah. So similarly here in the US, you have to buy your insurance, but depending on your plan, we have what's called an HMO versus a PPO. So on the HMO, you need a referral. So this is the same idea. So if you're on an HMO plan, which typically a lot of companies, you know, will opt for because it tends to be cheaper a lot of the time, you must see your GP and they must refer you to, you know, your specialist. And that's the kind of insurance that I was on as a child. And it was, I got to say, it was terrible. And
well,
we hated
our GP. It's frustrating when something's really wrong with you because
and you're like, I need
to go see someone
person.
Quickly. And it's a long process, right? So if you have to wait for an appointment to see your GP, then you see them, then they give you the referral, then you have to call around and find, you know, if the person that can take you, and then you have to wait for that appointment. It can be weeks sometimes,
right?
Depending on your insurance.
Yeah. So continue.
Yes.
The other advantage, I think, with the German system, it is obviously more expensive, I guess, if women can just, but they have, the state will pay for one's yearly checkup, a gynae checkup.
Right.
But the nice thing is, once you have chosen your gynecologist, you will stay with this person for a long, long time. So you don't have to repeat your history. And my gynecologist knows all about my past. I don't have to, you know, tell her how many children I've got. I don't have to tell her what different kind of pills I've tried.
Right.
I don't have to tell her anything. She's got it all. And it's quite easy. I go there and she's like, oh, Mandy, how's your libido? And I'm like, okay. So you have that relationship, that rapport of trust that takes years to build something.
Absolutely.
Whereas here in the UK, if you get referred, you see a specialist, but next time for your next appointment, you see a different person and you have
really?
A different
appointment.
Yeah. Oh my God.
If you're lucky, you see possibly the same person provided they are working that day at the time of your appointment, but this is not always a given.
Wow.
So it is very disrupted, I think, but it is effective with regards to workforce. They have a much smaller number of doctors and manage a much larger cohort of patients. So
right.
It is much more effective than in Europe and is more expensive in Europe. But anyway, I came over here in 2002 as a junior doctor and I thought I could just go and seek out a gynecologist and go and see them as before every year for my checkups. The GP looked at me and said, well, no, you come here, you see the nurse for your smear every 3 or 5 years. And unless you have a problem, there are no checkups. I'm like, okay.
Oh my God.
Okay.
This is like blowing my mind, Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
So you only basically in the UK see your doctor if you have a problem. There is, apart from what you call in the UK, you call them pap smear. In the US, they're called pap smears.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We just call them smears. Yeah.
So here, a schmear would be cream cheese on a bagel.
Cream cheese on a bagel. Yeah, if you don't put pap in front of it, people think you're talking about cream cheese, which...
Okay.
Now that we're talking about vaginas, just elicits all kinds of visuals and
your
things.
Your schmear.
So we do have a separate clinic, which is sexual health related. So if you think you have an STI or a sexual transmitted disease as a person, you can go to these clinics and they are fairly accessible. So you can just turn up, you walk in, or you don't need a referral. So they try and make it easy to remove barriers for sexual health. And the pill is easy to get. Now, that is not the problem. But if you have a genuine gynae problem as a woman in the UK, it takes many, many years to get help. And I was perimenopausal from my 40s, early 40s. I was tired, fatigued. I couldn't function. I'm like, something is wrong. I went to my GP and I felt they're good doctors. You know, they exclude major things. They won't let you die. they will make sure they do run a few blood tests to make sure that you're okay. But beyond that, you know, if your blood tests, your thyroid function, whatever, they test it comes back as normal. There's nothing beyond that. Or they give you antidepressants, which I wasn't. I wasn't depressed. I went back to Germany and my gynecologist there for the first time mentioned the word perimenopause. And that was because she knew me and she said, Mandy, you know what? It's not normal to feel like that. You shouldn't feel like this. Let's explore this a bit further. And I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. And I did actually start some treatment, some HRT, which I found helpful. And then I thought, oh my God, if I am, as a doctor, have so much trouble to get help, how is a non-medical woman going to get help? How is she going to get where I am now? You know, so I got treatment that was effective. I got good advice and I got better. But, and then I realized maybe there is a big niche, a big area where women are actually underserved.
Absolutely.
I looked a bit more into how to get training, what the current provisions are in the UK. And so I did train with the British Menopause Society. And so it went from there, from basically my own experience started as a doctor, because I'm well placed. I can prescribe medication. I can read clinical trials. I can get, you know, I can explain the evidence and I can understand the evidence.
If I can interject for a second, listeners should 100% follow you on Twitter. If whoever's listening, we're going to leave all this information in the show notes. But whenever you post anything about a clinical trial or a new data on any kind of a study, I read everything that you put out there. You're always putting out the latest stuff. And listeners, this is so important to have at your fingertips. So if you not following her, you need to follow her so you can get all the latest information. It's really helpful. Yeah.
One of the reasons why I studied medicine in the first place is, in some respect, to understand my own body better, because I was fascinated by the biology. And lo and behold, as a doctor, I had no idea about perimenopause. As a doctor, right? It's a joke. Myself, a female doctor, no idea about perimenopause, no training whatsoever. And I hold my hands up and no, I did not seek it actively until I actually suffered. Mm. And that's bad. It shouldn't happen like that. You shouldn't be getting cancer as a doctor first and then have an interest in treating cancer, right? It's not good. But I wasn't aware as much as I am now. And I wanted to understand everything about it. So I read a lot about it. And I have a real passion about how the brain works, how our ovaries connect and communicate with the brain, and what happens to the ovaries as we get older and aging. It's a really fascinating area. And not just out of pure selfishness, because I want to age well. I want to do the best I can to be around for my children and have the energy to do my job that I love and not have a burnout, a nervous breakdown, because I'm in perimenopause. And isn't it sad that in the UK, there are statistics that show that 10% of women in perimenopause or menopause give up their job? That shouldn't be the case. Because of menopause, for no other reason, you know?
Very upsetting. I think, you know, there's clearly a gap in education about perimenopause amongst physicians all over the world, because both Julia and I, you know, we do a lot of research before we choose our doctors, and we've been to some very excellent OBGYNs who have, we've talked about this before, they've treated us incredibly well and incredibly successfully throughout our fertile years. You know, I have a child and Julia doesn't, but, you know, various problems that can happen with you and, you know, through pregnancy and birth and all of that. Fantastic. And then these same wonderful doctors, the minute we hit the period of perimenopause, mm-hmm. sort of shrug their shoulders, throw up their hands and say, you'll feel better when you're 50. You'll be done, you know, or yeah, I don't know, just keep taking the pill, which is working for me. But then what happens when I go off of it and how will that feel? Like, it's just so interesting. So this part of why we love you and part of why we started this podcast to, you know, and we see so many people out there now beginning to talk about this, and it shouldn't just be beginning, but it's something, it's a start, because we really do need more education, not just amongst ourselves as women, but the physicians we're seeking for treatment. Will you tell us about this Menopause Cafe? We're so excited to hear about it.
Yeah. So the Menopause Cafe, so when I did my training with the British Menopause Society, which is, you have the equivalent, which is the NAMS, the North American Menopause Society, which is like the big authority that publishes the best state-of-the-art guidelines. And we listen to those. We have a similar thing. It's called the BMS, the British Menopause Society.
Okay.
I trained with them and I met a colleague there. We really connected. And then we heard from this social franchise starting up in Scotland, where they realized there was a gap and women needed to know more about menopause. And they had successfully started what's called a social franchise. We then got together and thought, well, we've got this extra training now. How can we get this out into the wider public? What can we do with our knowledge to kind of help women? And so we thought, well, let's run a menopause cafe. So we looked in our local town to find a community center. We were allowed to use the space for very little money. Then Kathy, my colleague's mom, is an amazing baker. So she made cake. Ooh. She loved making cake. So she contributed the cake. we had coffee and tea there. And then we just put it out there. We foolishly printed leaflets. Can you imagine? We printed paper leaflets and we put them like out on public notice boards because obviously we hadn't heard of social media. It was like pathetic. It's really pathetic.
I think it's charming.
I love that it's like real grassroots,
it's like,
right?
Where's my and cat? Local. I've lost my cat. And you put it on down the road.
Mandy, wait, before you go on, have you watched the program Call the Midwife?
Of course. And you know what? I cry every time.
But
I'm sorry,
I know it takes place in the 1950s and 1960s, but they have clinics and they've got leaflets that they're posting all around the town. So that's what this is reminding me of, even though we're in the 21st century. Go ahead, carry on.
And we very quickly realized that that's not the way to go because we actually asked women who attended, where did you hear about us? And they, not one of them mentioned our leaflets.
Oh.
And we spent a lot of time creating them. Anyway, but you know, the local paper in the end published it and the radio picked it up. So we were able to spread the word and we were massively oversubscribed. So we had women queuing up and we were like, oh my God, this is scary because we can't actually let them in. We had one single man attending, a husband, and he was very scared. And he asked his wife, can I go to the pub instead? And he said, oh, go to the pub. So he was too afraid. You know, there was this room, 50 women, passionate women. And he's like, I can't. And he just went.
If that's not a sign that women have power, I don't know what is.
Yes. Yeah.
Am I right?
Yes.
Yeah, no, it's true. But we did try and accommodate. So men are welcome because they need to hear that too. It affects every single person in the family.
Sure.
Men are welcome to hear about it because they are supporting women and they often feel helpless. But the menopause concept is very, very clever in a sense that it brings women together from all walks of life, women and men and anyone who wants to come, apart from children, they can come together. And it's a way of exchanging experiences, talking about what you go through with each other. Not so much a support group in that sense. So there's no one obliged to support the other person because we cannot do that. You can't attend somewhere and then feel responsible for the other person breaking into tears. It's not your job, but we can be supportive in other ways. So we can be listening, for example.
Listening,
but it's not a psychological support group. It's just a group where you just exchange so that you maybe feel no longer alone. And the other thing is they have very, very strict rules that you have to adhere to. If you want to use the Menopause Cafe label, you have to sign a contract to use the franchise and advertise it under that name, which makes sense. Initially, we didn't get it because we as doctors thought we could give talks about HRT. We thought we could give information. And actually, they didn't want that. And only afterwards, we understood why, because that platform afterwards was used by other people to sell women things, you know.
Mm-mm.
And this is not what it is. It's not a sales platform. You should not run a menopause cafe if you want to sell your magnet that isn't proven to do anything. That's just quackery. That's just abusing vulnerable women's situation under the umbrella of helping them. It's not helping. So in the end, this is not where doctors should turn up and tell women what to do or give personal advice. It's about women connecting and realizing, oh my God, I'm not the only one who goes through this. I'm actually normal. This is fine. You know, I'm normal.
Right.
And it's hard. And let's just, you know, agree it's hard. Or someone else might say, it's actually easy for me. Or how can I help my mom who's going through this? Or how can I help my daughter who is going through this? You know, because it affects younger women as well. So it's a not-for-profit. Well, you can take a couple of pounds for expenses, but you should. It's not a commercial opportunity to sell things, supplements or anything. It should be neutral from commercial interest. It should be neutral from medical advice. Women should not be talked into starting or trying something. It is really just a platform to get together, and you can do it online. Anyone can do this. They have had them internationally. They do encourage you to sign this contract that you adhere to their ethical rules.
You have to have rules for this to run correctly.
Right.
Yeah, because otherwise it becomes a sales platform.
It could go awry in many ways.
Yeah.
I love that idea of creating a community. And even though you said you can do it online, I think that there are many online platforms and those can also go, you know, even when rules are set, it devolves into arguments and all kinds of things. And I know the pandemic makes this difficult, but the idea of gathering in a room in person with not even necessarily like-minded, but people who are all going through the same thing and looking at them and connecting and saying, yes, I have felt that way. Yes, you probably leave feeling supported and filled up in a way that you certainly wouldn't. Online can be so cold, just typing, you know?
And feeling seen, I think, yes, is the biggest thing.
Literally.
Yes. And also you may come out connecting with one specific woman who becomes your friend. Or yes, you may go off and actually host this in your own village. It's meant to be as a chain reaction to instill the sense of you're not alone. Menopause happens to every single woman who lives long enough to, is lucky enough to live long enough. It happens to young women, and just talk about it without fear in a safe, confidential space, you know, like you do on your podcast, but on a bigger scale and confidential rather than
for everyone to hear.
Yes.
It's so good. There's so little that's positive these days. And this is so positive and wonderful. And I just love it.
I love it too. And well, listeners,
well,
we'll
host one.
Well, I was, trust me, the thoughts are.
Of course, we're both
spinning.
We have the same brain in certain ways. And we're both thinking about discussing this once we get off.
Listeners, we'll put this information in the show notes. And we encourage you to start your own menopause cafe and sign the contract and adhere to the rules, because that's very important. But we'll put that in the show notes at the end. I wanted to call back to something that you mentioned earlier just a few moments ago, and it segues nicely into a question I had already prepared. So I'm very excited. I was reading, you know, all these articles that you contributed to for different science publications and so forth that you have on your website. There, you know, we'll put the links in the show notes. But there is one that you had talked about. It was like post-reproductive health, which I read and I thoroughly enjoyed, because you talk about one of my favorite subjects, which is the use of antidepressants to treat symptoms associated with perimenopause and menopause symptoms. And I think I've told the story before, but you know, when I first went, speaking of, like, you know, going to the OBGYN that you've loved for years, similar situation, this woman, I just adored her. I've been going to her for so long. And I went to her and was like, I got this stuff going on. And the first thing she offered me was an antidepressant. And I looked at her and I said, but I'm not depressed. Why would I take an antidepressant? And there was nothing offered to me beyond that, other than going on the birth control pill, which does not, I don't do well on that. I've tried many times. So there was just no solution beyond that. And I had to like seek out a functional, in the States, we have functional medicine doctors, mm-hmm, which have a more holistic, you know, approach to the body. And now I'm on some HRT and I've made a lot of lifestyle changes. So some of my problems have resolved. I'm doing a lot better. But can you tell our listeners about the premise of that article and a little bit about what you discovered when you wrote it?
Yes. So this connects with what we've been talking previously about doctors not necessarily having an insight into what happens during perimenopause, biologically even. You know, they may see a 44-year-old woman who attends the clinic and says, I'm feeling tired. I haven't slept for 6 months. I feel anxious. I'm not enjoying things anymore. But I feel drained, and what can I do?
That was exactly what I said.
And this is typical. And first of all, she will very unlikely be asked about a menstrual cycle. You know, she will not be asked, have you started skipping periods? Are they more close together? Are you bleeding like crazy? Are you flooding? What's happening with that? And that's not likely, because they're not interested, or they're not making the connection between ovaries and well-being. This is the first thing. Doctors possibly not recognize, and I do not want to possibly say that every doctor's the same.
Sure, but we'll say a lot of doctors, and we've had these experiences.
And so what they hear is, she's not sleeping, she's not functioning, she's anxious, she must be depressed, she's really busy, she's stressed, she's got 3 kids, you know, this is depression, let's just help her out quickly with an antidepressant quick fix. But it isn't a quick fix. And the problem is, I have no problem with antidepressants. I think they are a real lifesaver at the right moment for the right person. And they do work. They do work for clinical depression. There's no doubt about it. In some cases, they are very useful. But I think the perimenopause is a specific time where Professor Studd, who's now passed away, he coined this term reproductive depression.
Ooh, I like it.
So these are forms of depression or mood-related problems that are associated with reproductive organs. So that could be starting in puberty with PMS or PMDD, premenstrual dysphoric disorder. That could be postnatal depression, which happens not because you're depressed about the baby, because your hormones have suddenly changed and your brain can't cope. Yeah. And the same happens. So there's the puberty when hormones go a bit haywire. Then there are periods, menstrual cycle, mood-related issues, and then postnatal. And then there's another stage in life of the woman, which is perimenopause and menopause, when things change again. So it is important for doctors to understand the female life cycle is not a constant. It's not like a man. He's born, he survives puberty, and then it just goes like that.
He can make babies until he's on his deathbed.
Yeah. Between 20 and 90, he's the same.
Yeah.
There's no flux. There's a little bit of declining testosterone later on. But overall, he functions. In women, it's like that. So I'm just, you can't see this because it's a podcast and I forgot, but it's basically ups and downs. That's the female life cycle and it's normal. However, antidepressants do not necessarily treat the underlying problem very well. They treat the symptoms. And I'm not saying that a woman who starts antidepressants, who is perimenopause, may not feel slightly better. They may help her to function a little bit better, but they will not address the underlying symptoms, which are hormonal fluctuations, or which are reduced stress resilience, which are anovulatory cycles. So you're making no progesterone, but lots of estradiol. So, and if you're looking at maybe an autoimmune condition, which is a result of hormone fluctuation. Yeah. So I think we need to look beyond just the symptom and saying, yes, she's anxious. This is the symptom. Let's treat the symptom. We need to treat the underlying cause. And sometimes you may need to start HRT. Sometimes you can just do basic lifestyle changes. Like the one I'm very passionate about is alcohol.
Yes.
And a lot of women in that time, they medicate with alcohol. But if a doctor asks a woman, you know, you're not sleeping, you are feeling anxious, what do you do about it? Do you have your drink? And she's like, oh God, yeah, without my two gin and tonics at night, I can't go to bed. And he would then, this is the point where he should say, you know what, that could actually make your symptoms worse. Right. Have you tried stopping? Yeah. So, you know, this is the first thing you need to ask women. What do they actually do to help? And what do they not do? Do they exercise? Do they have a healthy diet? Or do they just eat the children's leftover because they're so stressed? So it is much more complex. But in the UK, I don't know what it's like in the US, doctors have 10 minutes for each person, for each patient.
Wow.
10 minutes. It's not enough. So, and that's how I got very frustrated with my own national health service job. I got a bit frustrated with only having 10 minutes for very complex issues. Assessing someone with anxiety and physical burnout symptoms, you need more than 10 minutes.
Mm.
It's difficult. It's complicated. So I do provide in the private sector as much as I obviously would rather that every woman has access to free medical advice. In the private sector, we can take as long as we want, right? An hour or whatever.
I think that's wonderful. And I had noticed on your website, I love that you offer, you know, you offer private patient access, and then you also offer it within the NHS system is what I had read. And I think that that's so important because here in the US, sadly and unfortunately, you know, like I said, if you go to a functional medicine doctor like I do, I'm very lucky. I have something called out-of-network benefits with my insurance. So they'll cover, this person's out-of-network, they don't take insurance, but my insurance will cover a portion of it. And the fact of the matter is that a lot of functional medicine doctors in the US, and I'm not saying this is every doctor, but I think a lot of doctors have really seen this as a niche market where they can make a profit. And I think it's a shame that many of them are not taking insurance, and that really shuts out a lot of the population who really need them, including the person that I'm seeing now. So I think it's so awesome that you take care of both populations. I think that's really important.
Yeah, I also try, when I saw someone privately, I often start them on something. And then when it works, they can be referred back into the National Health Service.
So, fantastic.
You know, if you figured out what worked for you, you may have to adjust it. You may have to tweak it a little as you go through the journey of perimenopause. But it doesn't mean that going forward, it won't work again. Because what may work in terms of treatment like HRT now, when you're 46, may not have the same effect when you're 50, and because your levels change, your hormone levels change. So this needs to be something. I think as humans, we always look for the magic wand, for the single cure for all evil, and antidepressants have been that.
It's an easy go-to thing.
Yeah. It's not a magic wand. But I'm not saying that some women do not benefit from it. That's not the point. It's just it takes hard work to be well. And it is never just a standalone prescription. It's more than that. It's nutrition, it's exercise, it's lifestyle, it's not smoking, not drinking, it's setting boundaries, it's saying no, it's not longer putting up with people's bullshit. You know, as I said at the beginning, you know, the word saying no to people is the hardest thing I had to learn in my life.
Mm.
It's like, and I have so many women who feel so guilty about saying no. They come to see me and they cry and they say, you know, I shouted at my children and I'm so tired of picking up the washing and the laundry from my teenage children. And I haven't got the patience anymore. And then I cry because I shouted. And I'm like, well, you need to learn. This is the time that you learn to say no, no longer. You pick that up.
Yeah.
No, I don't. So if you don't put your dirty washed laundry in the laundry basket, you will have no clean clothing. It's simple. But a lot of women, this is the time when for the first time they realize they need to say that, you know, no.
I think women spend a lot of time beating themselves up mentally and physically, right? Like you said, the alcohol, you are beating yourself up when you drink regularly, when you constantly go for fried foods and junk food, you are beating yourself up. And when you, the things you just spoke about, you tell yourself you have to do it all. And that if you don't do it all, or your bucket becomes overfull and you snap, then you beat yourself up for not being able to do it all. And then you beat yourself up for snapping. And so you're constantly hurting yourself in all of these ways. And then how can you expect to feel good and sleep well and be calm? And it's great that you look at all of those aspects, because, you know, you talked about having 10 minutes here in the States. That is not the case. At least I've never experienced that. I've spent ages with doctors. And yet in that time, maybe they will say, oh, you don't exercise enough, you should exercise more. But I have never had a doctor tell me you really shouldn't drink. I have never had a, they ask you how many cocktails you have in a week, but then that's it.
They ask you on a questionnaire that
on
they
a questionnaire,
don't read. That they
right,
don't
they,
read.
Oh, oh
they
gosh,
have to go through a certain number of questions. And in those questions are, do you exercise? What do you do for exercise? How often do you exercise? How many alcoholic beverages do you have? You know, these are the questions, but then they don't really get addressed. Except in my experience in the past, when I have not really been exercising, they say, well, you know, now you're 40, you really ought to be exercising for your heart health and whatever. And now I do. But nutrition, it's so shocking to me that it doesn't get spoken about, because it can affect so many parts of how you feel. So yeah, what you're doing is great. And we're big fans.
Thank you, Ellie. But at the end of the day, I am not the person who has to make the changes. I'm just the person guiding the woman. But I think sometimes women are already on the right track. They just need that little stimulus, that little kick up the backside, really. They already know, you know, you have friends, I'm sure, who know the red wine. They pay for it the next day and they know full well that they don't feel that. And they have this... If they just listen to their body a bit better, they would realize, or you know, most of the women I see actually have already scaled down alcohol. They already realize they don't tolerate it, but they struggle to make the appropriate steps that they are able to actually do properly.
Right.
And also, when you have so many different things to work on, where do you start? Do you start with your food? Do you start with exercise? You can't do everything. So one step at a time, you know, that habit stacking.
Yes.
It's basically where you pick one thing at a time. And then you make it a habit that you will do without thinking. So, for example, in the morning, you get up, you open the curtains, you don't roll over in bed and have another snooze because you're so tired and feel like death won't up. No, you get up, you go to the window, you look at the bright light, you get that cortisol, breathe, you shake your body. That's a tiny thing, costs nothing, it's easy. And it gives you that cortisol awakening response. You know, you start the day with a healthy breakfast.
Mandy, you are speaking a language that I absolutely adore. All of this holistic approach, these very easy steps, everything from getting that sunlight in the morning to not drinking at night. I mean, these are such small things that people can start with immediately.
And also saying no to people who annoy you, who want to meet with you and say, oh, let's meet. And you think, actually, I don't feel good with that person in the room. It sucks my energy out.
Yes.
And do I really want this? Or am I just a people pleaser here who is trying to be nice? And you don't need to be nice all the time. Okay. No. It's okay not to be nice. It's okay to look after yourself first, to after your sleep. And if you don't feel like going out in the evening, it's okay. You want an early night, have an early night, and then go out when you feel like it. So I think this habit stacking day where you look after yourself, where you think about, is this good for me or not? Once you've consolidated one habit, it becomes effortlessly like having a cold shower in the morning or something. You can't live without it. And then you add another habit, like going out for a good walk every day, starting small. I couldn't run a marathon for toffee. I can't run, but you know, I go for walks and that's fine. That's okay with me. But equally, if you want to go for a run, do it. You know, so it's these small habits that you can do to look after yourself. And I think the perimenopause is the time where you should really invest in your health. This is so important, because I'm not saying it's too late later on, but this investment that you put in your health now pays off big time later on in your 50s, late 50s and early 60s. And you still benefit from your muscles that you build now, mm-hmm. the healthy bones, the mental health, the brain health. It will carry on an investment that really pays off later on because you're in a vulnerable state. But if you learn healthy habits now, you can carry them through into later life and that pays off.
That's great. That's wonderful. And that's a great time to transition into our final four because I don't think we can get better than the habit stacking.
I agree.
All right, let's do it. Mandy, are you familiar with our final four? Our final four questions that we ask every guest?
At the end of every episode?
I have listened to you. You know, the thing is, I do listen to your podcast, but usually I have 20 minutes in the car. So maybe they cut me off after 20. So I may have missed
don't
that.
Don't worry.
Listen, we just had a whole conversation about burnout and not having time and saying no. And we do not. Listen, we're excited that we got you on here and that you would listen to it at all. So welcome and thank you. And now we're going to ask you just four more questions because that's our little, that's what we do. It's our little surprise thing at the end. Okay. Question number one, what do you wish you understood at 30 that you know now?
That nothing stays forever. Life is always in flux. Nothing is forever.
Yes. That's great. Question two, what do you have an abundance of?
I have a lot of creativity. I think I do have all sorts of ideas still that I want to do. For example, I thought about, and sadly it already exists, a murder mystery about menopause. You know, menopausal women killing people. the menopause murders is already a range of books that some other woman has come up with.
That's crazy.
Good for her. So, you know, no, or things like that. Also, I wanted to be an archaeologist or an Egyptologist and things like that. I like history, medical history. And so I still have this drive to understand history, where we fit in now and the creativity maybe. So I'm not saying I'm super creative. It's my own creativity, right? I'm not saying I'm coming up with something that is worthwhile for other people, but I enjoy creativity. So I think I have an abundance of creativity. Whatever comes out of it doesn't matter. It's not.
I do not value
what I do with regard to the outcome. It doesn't have to be something that makes money or is enjoyed by other people. Something I just like.
It's not what it's about. Yeah. No, I think, I mean, if there's one thing I feel like there is about you that I mean, we've just met, but you certainly have what I would call hunger for knowledge. And a curiosity, which is really beautiful. And I totally see that. And I really love it. Question number three, what part of your body are you most proud of and why?
Okay.
Everyone gets a little stuck on this one.
Probably my feet.
Okay.
We've never had this one before.
No, yeah, this is a new one.
I like my feet. I'm a size 6 or 39. I don't know okay.
Yeah. 39 is a US size 9. That's the same foot size I have.
Yeah. I like my feet. They are doing a great job. They carry me every day. I'm very proud of my feet. They look nice. They're small. I mean, I have small toes. So I like my feet. They've never failed me.
I like it.
I love that you gave us an answer we've never gotten before. That's brilliant. And then what single piece of advice would you give to the next generation of women to prepare them for the transitional changes to come?
I would say if you've got daughters and sons, it doesn't matter. If you have children, please talk to your children about not only about you, how you feel, but what happens with women and in the life course of a woman. And both girls and boys have to understand that because the boys will have girlfriends who will have these problems, or they will have daughters in their own right who will have these problems, or they have friends who have these problems. And the girls need to be prepared. And I'm actually writing a book about with my friend, Dr. Hannah Short, about early menopause, because that's a very underserved community.
Yes.
Women under 45 or women with POI, premature ovarian insufficiency, are under the age of 40. And some are as young as 14. They never had ovarian function. So they're menopausal from the age of 14.
Wow.
They never go through normal puberty. I would like to say that menopause can happen at every age. It happens to every woman, every single one who lives long enough will experience it. And it doesn't affect just you as a person. It affects all the people around you. And also I would say, if you feel angry because you're perimenopausal and your children don't understand, tell them, you know, mommy is having a bad day. It's not your fault. It's because things are happening in my body, which are hard to deal with sometimes, but I will get better and you can help me by unloading the dishwasher.
Mm. I like it.
I think emotions are valid and don't hold them in. If you're angry, you're angry, right? But don't let them. And if you do let them out on other people, it's not the end of the world. But I think explain why you feel that way. Don't go crying in a dark corner and think it goes away. It doesn't.
Yeah. If there's anything we've learned, I think it's that being open about the conversation, like this shouldn't be a shameful conversation. These should be conversations that we can have openly without feeling shame. And people should be open to understanding and listening to what we have to say about it. So, yeah. We have a bonus question, and it's really not a question. It's more of a statement. So I'm going to read the statement to you, and I want you to fill in the blanks. Okay. No matter how many blank I own, I always buy more.
It's a very close tie between books and handbags, I'm afraid.
Books and handbags. Yes.
Handbags big enough to hold your books.
Correct. You know, you can never have enough handbags or books.
I agree. True.
I'm not very environmentally friendly and I do like the paper book. I just Same. Like to hold a book, smell it. And I just cannot get to grips. I am not at the Kindle stage yet.
Me neither.
Me neither.
But I always pass my books on to someone else and yes, hope that they then course. Pass yeah. them on to someone else. So hopefully we're paying it forward with our books.
Like a book swap. Yeah, I'm all about the book swap. I do the same thing.
Mandy, it's been so nice to meet you and so lovely to speak with you. And you've given us a lot of really great things to think about and spread around. So I appreciate you being on the pod today.
Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me, Ellie and Julia. And it's a real pleasure and fun to speak with you too. And I'm glad we made this and got to meet.
I love it too. Yeah, thank you so much. And to learn more about Dr. Mandy Leonhardt and the work that she does, along with Menopause Cafe and basically everything that we just spoke about, we will leave that information in the show notes. Thank you again, Mandy. This was great.
Thanks, Julia. Thank you, Ellie.
Habit stacking, Julia.
I cannot wait to stack my habits, and I can't wait to start our own Menopause Cafe.
We're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
And I can't wait to tell my son that he can really help my well-being by like unloading the dishwasher.
He's 8, right?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. So maybe I should give him a task that's like lower to the ground and less breakable. I'll think
I
about
mean,
it.
Maybe. Yeah, sounds wise. Listeners, we welcome your suggestions of chores that Ellie's son can do that will help her mental and physical well-being. In the meantime, please keep listening to our podcast, review it if you haven't already done so, and share it with anyone you think might enjoy it. You can also support us at Patreon by clicking the support button on the episodes page of our website or by going to patreon.com/circlingthedrainpodcast.
And now we will end with fewer fucks to give. Mm-hmm. Today, I have fewer fucks to give about saying no to energy vampires. Dr. Mandy says, nice sound effect.
Thank you.
Dr. Mandy says I don't have to hang out with them, just to people please. So I say, no energy vampires.
I like it.
I won't go to your party.
Yeah. And I have fewer fucks to give about letting my emotions out. Dr. Mandy says that holding them in is damaging, so out they shall come, and I won't apologize for it.
No sorries. Mm-mm. Speaking of energy vampires, just sidebar, like I have to recommend the show What We Do in the Shadows.
Yes.
It is not new, but I recently discovered it. You may have even recommended it to me, and it is excellent fun. It's so funny.
I love that show. It's based on a movie by the same name that is also hilarious, and I have a big crush on Taika Waititi, the writer and director. Just tell my husband,
Think he knows.
I think he might have a crush on Taika Waititi.
You can have an imaginary Taika Waititi threesome.
That, yes. No, maybe?
Yes, no,
this
maybe.
This episode was produced by me, Julia Grudnacki.
And me, Ellie Dvorkin Dunn. As always, listeners, we feel your pain.
You're not insane.
You haven't gone down.
You're just circling the drain.